Hello and welcome to episode 48 of the Clippings podcast, where we review nail papers and share them with you. I'm April Schachtel, and I'm joined today by my co-host.
Hi, it's Jasmine Rana here.
All right. The Council for Nail Disorders had its annual virtual conference, part two, last week, and it was full of clinical pearls. So we thought it would be fun to do a rapid fire of some high yield pearls for our listeners, although not an exhaustive list from what was a great meeting. And each of us have also prepared a deep dive into an article that was mentioned. So I'll hand it over to Jasmine to get us started on some clinical pearls.
Definitely. No, I just want to echo this was a fabulous meeting. So thank you to everyone who put that together. So to start, we had an update from Doctors Iorzo and Dr. Diciaccio. Forgive me for the pronunciation. It was an update on lichen planus of the nail unit. And a few pearls that I took away were number one, biopsies in the nail unit, when we're trying to diagnose nail lichen planus really depend on the disease presentation. So whether it's in the nail bed or the matrix, so having that clinical skill to identify that can improve the yield of our biopsy, right? And we actually touched on this a little bit last month in our podcast as well, where we talked about the tangential nail biopsy approach. Another reminder was that there may be higher rates of skin atrophy in children, and this was noted in a study of a pediatric population. And it is felt that this is due to the fact that the periungual skin is thinner in kids. So, considering a max dose of 0.2 milliliters of intralesional steroid and also using lower concentrations. So, for example, I often use like 5 mg per mil to 10 mg per mil in the adult population. So, I think in a kid, I might be more tempted to start with like a 2.5 mg per mil, for example. And then finally, we talked a little bit about JAK inhibition. So as a reminder, JAK stands for Janus kinase inhibitor, and it's this new class of immune suppressants that's used all across diseases in dermatology, and it's now used off-label for severe and refractory nail lichen planus. And so there was some discussion about this in that there's been some encouraging case reports looking at both the systemic use mainly. And then anecdotally was shared that I think Dr. Irizarry mentioned that it was a game changer for her using topical tofacitinib, which is a topical JAK inhibitor. It's not something that I personally have had the chance to use much for this disease. And so I was curious, April, have you used topical or systemic JAK inhibitors with any success for nail lichen planus?
Yeah, it's great you mentioned it. We had this meeting just was that last weekend, and then I saw two patients with nail lichen planus this week, and one of them I have now requested to get the topical to try a topical JAK inhibitor for them for their nail lichen planus. I don't know how likely I'm going to be to get it approved with their insurance, but I did go and double check in Skin Medicinals, where I like to find no conflict of interest, but I like to find a lot of medicines that are otherwise hard to get through insurance. And they have the topical tofacitinib for $75 for a 30 gram tube. So I may be trying that next if insurance doesn't go the way we want to on that. And it might be a little bit challenging because I looked and there's not really published data yet on the topical JAK inhibitors and nail lichen planus. So I really hope someone does try it and publish it so that we'll have some more data to be able to point to when we make a case for this, for insurance.
Totally. And I think one of the pearls about the topical use was doing it under occlusion. So that's something that I'll definitely keep in mind if, we need to try it off label. But yeah, exciting. And hopefully a case review of sorts will be coming out soon about that.
Yeah, I hope so.
Great. And then next, we also had some helpful pearls about self-induced nail disorder. So, specifically, onychotillomania by Doctors Pieruccini, Segal, and Saichi. So, one pearl Dr. Pieruccini shared with us was something that she termed the too much sign, which I really loved. So, she was talking about a case of onychotillomania of the feet, which is rare, but she was noting that it's helpful to look for too many signs that don't fit a single presentation. So particularly the presence of blood spots and kind of ragged, frayed nails, kind of looking like an outside job, so to say, and also looking for concurrent fingernail involvement. Sometimes these cases can be hard to distinguish from lichen planus, which I know anecdotally has been challenging for me. And then I loved her pearl, which was, it can be helpful to ask your patients, is your nail not growing well? And if not, how do you fix it? Because it's sometimes helpful to identify a tool that a patient may be using, which they may not, disclose, or it may not be obvious to ask. So things like clippers, scissors, files, tweezers, and whatnot. So I thought that was helpful. Some other clinical features that can be helpful to identify include a macrolunula, so kind of a large lunula, that half moon shape from the chronic repetitive trauma. Looking for hangnails or heme crusts kind of around the periungual skin, reactive melaninichia, wavy lines, nail bed hemorrhages, and nail pigmentation. And some of these can be picked up on dermoscopy. So I thought that was really helpful because sometimes it can be tempting to think about the role of a biopsy, but if we're able to diagnose clinically, that can obviously be very helpful. And then lastly, there was a discussion on treatment, and I just wanted to highlight that, N-acetylcysteine was something that came up as something that our, dermatologists have prescribed. Partnership with psychiatry is super important if there's comorbid anxiety or depression, for example. But, overall, it sounds like, in addition to pharmacologic treatment, non-pharmacologic treatment can also be helpful. So I wanted to mention a few things. So things like occlusive ointments, tapes, habit reversal. So for example, using like a fidget spinner, a stimulus control. So essentially kind of having another outlet instead of picking up the nail. So chewing gum, for example, aversion therapy, such as bitter nail polish, and then cognitive behavioral therapy. So an example of this could be like a reminder wristband, which I know they sell. Prices can vary, of course, but a patient will wear a wristband and it will remind them when they're having a behavior that they want to get rid of. So, lots of options. And, I personally have probably used N-acetylcysteine once or twice. And so I don't have too much experience with it. But curious, April, have you ever found that helpful? And do you have any pearls about kind of how you counsel your patients when starting N-acetylcysteine?
Yeah, I've used it a good couple of times more often for skin picking behaviors in my general dermatology clinic than in onychotillomania, but I have tried it there as well. Some success. I wouldn't say it's been overwhelming. I do find at baseline this is such a hard thing to treat anyway. I counsel patients to expect that they may get some sulfury burps. Been the biggest one, but I have not encountered any other side effects. I'm very clear to pull up what they need to look for exactly because they need to go buy it from a supplement store themselves rather than me being able to prescribe it, which I also think is often a big barrier between you recommending something and then that thing actually happening. I liked all these ideas. I have not tried many of them. I admit my kind of standard has been moisturizers. And, whenever you have the urge to pick, instead, massage some Neutrogena Norwegian formula hand cream into your nails and around instead. And, it's not as appealing even to pick or scratch at a greasy nail unit. But I think some of these treatments would help me probably get even more success with it. So I took note of those as well.
Yeah, no, it is so challenging. And I agree with you. I think I do try to remember to counsel patients about that kind of bitter aftertaste. That's a really good point. And I think the dosing starts at like usually like 600 milligrams. You can up titrate to like 2400 milligrams. And so I think what helps is to kind of take smaller doses more frequently to kind of not get that bitter aftertaste. But yeah, I think super important to counsel our patients and yeah, and partner and have us be a multidisciplinary team. So awesome. And then just to mention another pearl, so kind of moving on to a next topic. So Dr. Zayek reviewed some surgical tips for nail unit surgeries and specifically highlighted something called the submarine hatch biopsy approach. He actually published this in the JAD in 2014. Super helpful article with great photos if anyone is interested in learning more. But essentially the idea is it's a double two-step punch procedure of the nail plate and then underlying nail bed or matrix. And essentially, the idea is that the entire nail plate is not removed, but kind of like a tin can, a little bit is left over to readhere after the underlying nail bed or matrix pathology is biopsied. And the golden principle of nail surgery is to essentially take as little as you need, don't avulse more than you need. So I thought that this was a really creative approach and certainly could be useful in some situations. I think one downside is that, you have to be very clear about what you're biopsying because you don't get full visualization as opposed to like a trap door or a lateral curl approach. But really, really interesting surgical approach.
Yeah, wonderful. A few other tips I took away from the meeting were a case of a very resistant herpetic whitlow was presented, and we really went through the details of that patient who had that. And the pearl was to consider HIV testing if you have a patient who has herpetic whitlow, especially if it's a kind of resistant or atypical presentation. And some herpetic whitlow can be acyclovir resistant. And in those cases, the treatment is IV foscarnet, although that can be somewhat difficult to tolerate. I've seen that be successful in a resistant herpes simplex as well in the past, fortunately, just once. Nail sarcoidosis was also discussed. And if there is concern for nail sarcoidosis, either, because a patient's had a previous diagnosis of sarcoidosis or after a nail biopsy, you've identified the granulomas on the biopsy, a workup for systemic sarcoidosis should happen. And that should include imaging the underlying bones, as there can be arthritis, just right next to the matrix. And that can be related to the nail dystrophy and should definitely be identified if it's there. There are not firm guidelines yet, but if a patient has multiple nails affected, then the treatment ladder would include systemic steroids, hydroxychloroquine, azathioprine, and TNF inhibitors.
Yeah, that was a super interesting case. I agree. It was very humbling, and I'll certainly keep a lookout for that in patients with and without sarcoid because it could be the initial presentation as well.
Right.
Okay, and we also had a talk by Doctors Lipner and Blahovic on onychomycosis management, and each of us have prepared a summary of an article they discussed to review today. April, do you want to go first?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I wanted to briefly touch on an article titled Assessing Risk Amid Uncertainty Inside and Outside the Dermatology Clinic, which was published in the Journal of American Academy of Dermatology in October 2023. The authors are Stefan Vanderweil and colleagues, with the senior author being John Harris, all from the University of Massachusetts Department of Dermatology. I love this article because the authors address this really difficult topic of dealing with uncertainty. When we make a decision, we are often in reality not basing them on numerical risk, which would be the most logical, but we are actually basing them on our perception of the risk, which may or may not be accurate. So, in general, we tend to overestimate small risks, particularly if it's a potentially catastrophic harm. So, they give the example of that people fear dying in a plane crash. And for that, the risk is about one in 11,000 lifetime, more than they fear dying in a motor vehicle accident, which has a much higher lifetime risk, about one in 107, per this article. And they translate this over into the dermatology clinic, in which clinicians and patients may make decisions about risk that are, again, not based in the real likelihood of an event actually happening. And all of us who treat people with nail disease have had the experience of a patient being very worried about the liver risks of terbinafine. Oh, I don't want to take that. That's hard on my liver. I don't want to hurt my liver, kill my liver, et cetera. So that's the feels like a very real and very risky thing to patients when they hear about antifungals. Maybe it's because of a personal interaction that they've had with a friend or family member who took an antifungal and had a bad outcome, or something they have heard about through the grapevine. But the reality is that the actual risk of liver disease from terbinafine is one in 50,000 patients or one in 120,000 prescriptions, will have actual clinically apparent liver injury. So that was super interesting. This article also goes over some kind of non-nail relevant but dermatology relevant risks. So I'd really encourage, it's a short article and has a very nice visual with all the risks kind of laid out. That was really great to see. And then during the meeting, Dr. Lipner shared some additional data from an article from Gupta et al. That compared that to itraconazole having a clinically apparent risk of liver injury to be 10.4 in 100,000, so much higher than the terbinafine, and fluconazole having a risk of up to 1,000 in 100,000. So that would be, 2 per 100,000 for terbinafine, 10.4 for the itraconazole, and 1,000 for fluconazole. Interestingly, terbinafine is actually more likely to cause AST and ALT elevation, but the reality is that the azoles are much more likely to cause significant liver injury. And that, I think, is underappreciated, not well understood in clinic by clinicians or patients. And I thought this was really helpful for how I'm going to counsel my patients about risks of terbinafine and actually the azoles, which it's great to be basing this on actual data.
I totally agree. I also thought this article was awesome, and I particularly loved the figure that you had mentioned. I actually am so tempted to get that laminated and put it in my clinic because I think for a lot of relevant dermatology medications that we prescribe, including terbinafine, like you mentioned, it's just helpful to have a visual. I'm kind of reminded of there was an article published in JAMA Dermatology about, I believe, actinic keratoses and how the framing of how we frame this to patients can influence their decision to treat. And it just reminds me so much of that, right? So if you say like to a patient, oh, there's a 9 in 10 chance that, you won't experience a side effect, or you say there's a 1 in 10 chance that you will experience a side effect. We're saying the same thing, but depending on how we frame something, whether we like it or not, we really are influencing our patients' decisions. And so I remember when I was in medical school, kind of this move toward like more visual representation is kind of a nice way to take that bias as much as we can out of it to give our patients the facts and help kind of align their decisions with their values. So yeah, really, really great paper.
All
Great.
right. Yeah, Jasmine, what tell us about your article.
Super. So I reviewed an article titled Dermatophytomas and Onychomycosis, a Scoping Review of Prevalence, Diagnosis, and Treatment by authors Dr. Lipner, Vlahovic, Gadom, Olosky, and Dr. Joseph, published in the Journal of the American Podiatric Medical Association in spring of 2024. And as some background, as noted in the paper, just for definition, dermatophytomas are a mostly clinically diagnosed subtype of onychomycosis. The paper, I think, just describes this nicely. So it's described as a longitudinal streak or spike in the nail, usually presenting as a yellow-white streak or a patch in the subungual space with dense fungal masses encased in biofilm. So, in my experience, I would say clinically, I tend to diagnose this just by visualizing it, to kind of you know it when you see it, which isn't always great and is something that we're going to talk about in this article. Sometimes I find that it can be isolated, so just like in one digit. Often in my experience, it's usually the big toenail, but it can be concurrent with other types of onychomycosis as well. So, like distal lateral subungual onychomycosis. And, the premise of this paper is that, historically, the dogma has been to surgically remove or debride dermatophytomas as a key component of treatment. And I kind of think of this akin to like an aspergilloma kind of in medicine. The thought process here is that it's not just enough to give antifungal therapy. We also need to think about surgical resection if, the pharmacology or the, antifungal therapy isn't effective. And there's also been some data that it's really challenging to treat dermatophytomas with oral antifungals alone. So suffice to say, this paper wanted to review to see if this is in fact true based on some of the newer data that we're getting from topical and oral antifungal therapy. It's also helpful because a lot of patients with dermatophytomas tend to be excluded from clinical trials. So the authors acknowledge that there isn't much data in from clinical trials, and most of it has been case reports and retrospective data. I think it's really helpful because this is the first large-scale review on the topic, and it offers a really useful clinical takeaway, which I'll just mention right off the bat, which is that topical antifungal treatment, mostly studied for efinaconazole, can be effective and in some cases comparable and/or superior to oral treatments such as terbinafine without the need for any surgical intervention, like avulsion or debridement. And I should add that most expert consensus bodies, from what I've kind of read, really don't ever recommend avulsion for any type of onychomycosis, right? We know it's not effective, but debridement can always be a helpful adjunctive therapy. So just to kind of quickly run through the article, 37 papers were identified, and these were a mix of mostly case reports and retrospective data. So again, we don't have that much data, but of the ones that were identified, the authors looked at prevalence, diagnosis methods, treatments, and treatment efficacy. So I'll just go through each of those. So in terms of prevalence, dermatophytomas in the populations they were studied varied widely. So anywhere from less than 0.5% to 37%. And the authors acknowledge this isn't really unexpected because the populations varied. Some were immune suppressed, for example, and there's also a highly variable definition of what a dermatophytoma is. So you probably remember me saying you kind of know it when you see it. And unfortunately, there's no universal definition that has been used in studying this entity. So in terms of diagnosis, as you can imagine, if you don't have a great definition, this can also be challenging to actually keep track of. But the authors found that dermatophytomas in these studies were diagnosed using a combination of clinical tests, so most commonly potassium hydroxide and fungal culture, combined with the use of clinical identification. Histology, interestingly, I thought was used variably and not all that commonly. And Trichophyton rubrum, which is a dermatophyte species, was the most common, which, at least in the United States, is the most common species causing all fungal nail infections. So then lastly, kind of the treatment, which is kind of the really helpful, I think, clinical takeaway here. The authors again acknowledge that there's a wide variation in the definition of endpoints. So studies used a combination of undefined endpoints, clinical cure, and mycologic cure. However, when you put the data together, oral terbinafine and topical efinaconazole were the most frequently mentioned treatments. And the overall cure rate across different endpoints was highest with efinaconazole, which ranged from 41% to 100% with 48 to 72 weeks of treatment. And then I just wanted to quote this from the article, but essentially they tried to be more stringent and look just at studies with clinical and mycological cure. So they said in studies with five or more patients that provided at least one efficacy outcome, the highest cure rates for dermatophytomas were observed with oral terbinafine plus full or partial nail excision and topical efinaconazole. And I think the key takeaway here as well is that, if one is using an oral therapy, really encouraging our patients to do debridement may be helpful. And so that's something that I'm going to take away. Doesn't seem like that was needed for the topical efinaconazole to get high cure rates, but I certainly would recommend debridement in any case because it can't hurt. It can only help, it seems. So, really interesting and helpful paper. And I think, for me in my clinical practice, I was thinking, dermatology is such a specialty that we love our clinical pathologic correlations. And I would be so interested to see more data on if there's any specific or sensitive signs histologically to diagnose a dermatophytoma. Because, for example, if we read in a pathology report, a pathologist could identify like a mass of hyphae, they could say, consider dermatophytoma. As a clinician, we might actually change our management, right? Because if it is, we might say, oh, wow, it was only, one digit was affected. It really had the appearance of a dermatophytoma. Maybe I will recommend topical therapy, instead of terbinafine, for example, which would be supported by the data. So I'm curious if that's something that we would be worth looking more into at some point.
And maybe help make a better case for coverage of efinaconazole if we can show, hey, they have a dermatophytoma and it's not just my clinical assessment, it's also supported in this histopath report that's in the paper that's there in the computer. When you think about doing debridement, what does that look like for you? Is that like aggressive clipping back or numbing up and curetting. I don't think I've done tons of it, and maybe I don't need to.
That's a good question. I wasn't really trained on how to do debridement, at least in dermatology residency. And I think in talking to colleagues, everyone does it differently, especially I think podiatry versus dermatology, and also like geographically, like Europe versus the US. And for me, at least in our clinics, we don't have a protocol to debride in clinic, but I just recommend, our patients use kind of the bigger clippers at home to really make sure they keep their nails as short as possible. And I kind of explain it as you're debulking the fungal load. So as the new nail grows in, there's less for it to get reinfected, so to say. But yeah, I mean, it's something that we don't really have a lot of consensus on, like what is the best, approach to debridement. And of course, patient adherence, practical, things, it may not always get done. And I would just add to what you said about the cost of efinaconazole. I agree with you. I think the biggest barrier to me using this is insurance coverage. And so, one thing I will say is that, whatever topical you're able to get, approved is probably better than none. And so, I've had some luck anecdotally with cyclopurox and tivabrol, which are generic trade names for the other two FDA-approved nail lacquers in the US. This paper also mentions topical luliconazole, which also had a success rate of more than 50%. So, it does seem like there is something unique about these dermatophytomas that is more susceptible to topical therapy.
Last point I'll add is just on the clipping back. If when I do see someone with significant onychomycosis, I try to clip as much in clinic too as possible. But the one area I've run into issues or that I'm careful on is on the medial nail fold. I'll be cautious over there because clipping that area back too aggressively can lead to, when there's a lot of distal onycholysis, can lead to an ingrown nail there and sort of that, distal bulging nail bed. So that's the one area where I'm a little bit more cautious. And everywhere else, I'll also try to clip quite a lot away.
A really good pearl. And I recently had a case of a patient with a dermatophytoma just isolated to the big toe associated with trauma. And I actually ended up getting an x-ray and found exostosis. And I've also seen it concurrent with ingrown nails as well. So there's so much unexplored, I think, about this entity. And I should mention recurrence rates were noted in this review, but I want to say the time that was studied was not longer than a year. So we really don't know, like, are these more apt to come back if there's some underlying like biomechanical trigger. And so I think, we're learning more and more about these every day in clinic, but I certainly will keep this at the back of my mind moving forward.
For sure. All right, Jasmine, thank you for joining me on this episode of Clippings. I want to thank our listeners for their attention. Please share this podcast with your colleagues and trainees and let us know how we're doing and which articles you'd like us to review on the show by contacting kristen.cnd@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at Nail Disorders. We are really excited, looking forward to 2025, and have a lot of great ideas for future episodes for all of you. The goal of the Clippings podcast is educational and informational in intent. It's not a substitute or resource for formal medical advice. Listeners should not delay formal medical care for any condition or medical question they have. The views are solely those of the discussants, and use of any content is at the user's own risk.